emerging black leaders for who? As one looks over the map of what passes for criminal justice in the state of black America, one cannot be but deeply troubled by the hold that the nation's prisons and jails continue to exert, not only over the lives and bodies of so many black people, but perhaps even more telling, over the psyche of a generation of black youth. That's because the question isn't whether or not one is ill-served by the criminal justice system. The question is, what is the purpose of it, and who does it serve? If its purpose is to further the long war on black life as a kind of legalized, reconstructed vestige of the black codes that are at the core of American life and history, then we know who it serves. If so, we must tacitly, at least, admit it to ourselves and act like we know. For it is foolish to look at it as a kind of isolated and separate entity, alone and divorced from the general polity. It is at the very core of what is the state, and it isn't some remote reality. For black people in this country, no matter their individual or even class accomplishments, it stands as a threatening shadow presence that is as near as the next car stop, as urgent as a knock on the door in the night, or perhaps more realistically, a kick in of the door. Study after study has released the numbers, usually on an annual basis, so I won't bore you by restating them. What does this mean for young folks like many of you, perhaps the second generation of college-educated black folks, if not longer? Your credentials may provide entry into jobs and careers that your grandparents or great-grandparents could never have dreamed of. But what will you do when you get there? Whom will you serve? Will you spend your years laying brick and mortar to a system that you know is fundamentally unsound? Or will you be the builders of something, say, an independent black institution that follows your vision and your will? The question is, will you support the American imperial project, or will you oppose it? For there can never be empire abroad and true democracy at home. For what a nation does overseas, it will always, eventually, import it back home. And what a nation does at home, it will do abroad. Now, why do I say that? I'll provide two discrete examples, one recent, another from half a century ago. First, the latter. When the Third Reich began in Germany, it began with an unalloyed nationalist program that claimed to redress the nation's economic and social woes. This extreme nationalism, of course, gave way to xenophobia against other Germans who were perceived as not pure, not Aryan enough for the nationalists. There were pogroms against Jews, so-called gypsies or Romani, the few blacks in the country, Poles, and other so-called non-Aryans. These people were given a name in German law and indicted and imprisoned for racial crimes as Untermenschen, or in English, subhumans. In a matter of years, this nationalist movement became an international one that tainted and transformed first its neighboring European states of Poland, Austria, Czechoslovakia, France, and almost Russia. That's one example. You've all heard, I trust, of the Abu Ghraib scandal, the prison on the outskirts of Baghdad, where those horrific pictures of humiliation and torture took place. How many folks know that several of the prime actors in that scandal were Reserve National Guard officers who, in their civilian lives, worked as state and county prison guards here in the U.S.? Indeed, one of the most notorious of those in the photos, Specialist Charles Grainer, worked right here at SCI Green in Pennsylvania, some 60 miles from Pittsburgh. What a nation does at home, it will do abroad. Interestingly, a prisoner here at Green filed a suit against Grainer, charging him with placing razor blades in his food as an act of official revenge. While the suit was later thrown out for some reason, one cannot help but wonder, what if a judge didn't throw it out and found in the prisoner's favor? Would that have saved America and the world the spectacle of a leering army prison guard beating, humiliating, and abusing Iraqi detainees? We may never know. Some, perhaps the social scientists among you, will no doubt remark, well, what does one thing have to do with another? Well, it's foolish to speak of isolated things, for connections teach us much about the world. Well, of course, time differences exist between these two distinct examples. The historians among you will recognize that there were, despite the official lines, numerous ties between the Americans and the Nazis. U.S. firms profited from the German buildup to the war and from World War II itself, selling war materiel and critically needed parts. How many of us know that Hitler's two top tank producers were Adam Opel and Ford of Cologne, wholly owned subsidiaries of General Motors and Ford Motor Company? Or the companies like the Chase Bank, ITT, General Aniline and Film, Standard Oil, just to cite a few, traded with the enemy during the war? Or that the great American car maker, Henry Ford, received the Grand Cross of the German Eagle from Adolf Hitler, the highest award a foreigner could receive from the Nazi state? Or that Hitler was named Man of the Year by Time magazine? The point is not to malign these specific companies, some of which are still in business and contribute to worthy causes like scholarships and the like. The point is to raise the question, which side are you on? As people who have privilege and access and choices and time left in your lives, you must choose whether or not you will serve the empire. What will you become, a part of, and why? Will you contribute to strengthening the prison industrial complex, or will you contribute to the demolition of it? I don't speak about this as a kind of academic exercise. I've seen black guards, black counselors, black legislators, black wardens come and go. Not a one of them can point to prison as a system that successfully corrects people and prepares them for reentry into society. Most will say, unabashedly, that the system has failed. But for whom? For hundreds of thousands of people, it's not just a job, it's a well-paying career. Most folks in it don't need a college degree. For the poor, it is a social system of exploitation that steals their freedom while benefiting from the taking. I don't mean prison labor, that's a pittance. What I mean is every prisoner is counted in the national census as a resident of the county where the prison sits. These largely white rural counties gain thousands of so-called residents, and the resultant federal dollars that return in the form of grants, tax credits, etc., as well as increased representation in Congress due to the increased population. Meanwhile, this alleged resident comes from an urban inner-city community that loses population and also the resultant tax dollars both created and returned. His home community is further impoverished. The prison county is further enriched. And he is no more represented than his ancestor, who was counted as three-fifths of a person during slavery. This isn't rocket science, y'all. It's just common sense. Equipped with the right credentials, some young blacks will be courted and caught by huge transnationals, and they will devote their time and their minds to building the profits of a corporation. Some will work for the state. How many of you will work for black people? How many will work for community organizations? How many will work to give direction, a life-affirming direction, to black youth? When I began these remarks, I mentioned the hold exerted by the nation's prisons and jails over the psyche of black youth. I was referring to the blatant prostitution of our people's musical culture to promote a nightmarish image of gangsters, thugs, and pimps as somehow cool. As prisons are part of the longest war, so too is culture. One of the deadliest weapons against black people was the cinema, where vicious hate propaganda was unleashed like the 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation. The film ridiculed the fine and noble efforts of Reconstruction and portrayed white terrorists of the Ku Klux Klan as knights saving civilization. While not actually the birth of a nation, the film was the birth of American cinema, and it colored virtually every major film that came after it. It influenced government legislation and sparked vicious, deadly race riots across the nation. While that cultural tool has faded in its usefulness, American music corporations have found a new one, not starring whites in blackface, but utilizing the enormous talent of young black people to project images and mental pictures based on the lowest common denominator. In many of them, jails are portrayed as places of realness or coolness are places where men are made. Let me assure you that nothing could be further from the truth. Prisons are many things. Cool ain't one of them. They are vile places of humiliation, pain, loss, and death. No community can grow into health when young people look to prisons as a kind of rite of passage. It is true that the unjust economic inequities in this society, the richest empire on earth, pushes some people into the unfortunate position of crimes of survival, such as prostitution or drugs. But take it from me, prisons are the problem, not the solution. Young people like you, many of whom are in the arts, have a responsibility to your peers to try to project a more life-affirming vision. It's possible. Moreover, it's necessary. I thank you all for your kind invitation. On the move. Long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.